trying to pretend as if he's doing anything but cover for Donald Trump. Supposedly in his campaign, Donald Trump was going to release the files. Lo and behold, he's learned more, and he will do anything to avoid accountability and truth telling. And I think that's the very same thing with Andrew Cuomo. And you asked earlier, who are his supporters? They're the very same supporters as Donald Trump's supporters. They have the same donor base. They have the same people in their ears, same pollsters going to the White House saying you should support Andrew Cuomo. It's been well documented. And that's because these people value their power above all else.
And Lindsay Boylan, former senior aide to the disgraced former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who was forced to resign over charges of sexual harassment, now running for mayor of New York City. Boylan was the first of the 11 women to publicly accuse Cuomo of sexual harassment. That does it for our show. Juan Gonzalez will be speaking at Delaware Technical Community College in Georgetown, Delaware, tonight at 6 and tomorrow at 6 at the Delaware History Museum in Wilmington. I'll be speaking in Santa Fe after the showing of the film Steal the Story, Please, at the Lensic Theater on Friday night, October 17th. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month's nominating committee meeting will be held on Tuesday, October 21st at 5 p.m. This meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if the meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service helping those who are feeling sad, struggling with alcohol or drug use, or just need someone to talk to. Trained counselors are able to listen and provide support 24/7. Confidential support available by text or phone call to 988. More info at 988oregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a judge extends the temporary restraining order keeping troops off Portland streets.
Oregon Governor Tina Kotek stalls on signing the transportation package.
And in international news, the CIA ramps up operations in Venezuela.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 15th, 2025. I'm Jar Salem.
And I'm Terrence Burns. District Court Judge Karen Imrigut has extended her temporary restraining order keeping Trump from deploying National Guard troops to Portland for another 2 weeks. Without it, the court would have extended Saturday. A three-day trial for the case is scheduled on October 29th, though federal lawyers have tried to get it moved back. Both sides of the court dispute are awaiting an approval decision from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which heard the case last week. Judges signaled they will be likely to defer to the president, overruling Imrigut and the dissolving the restraining order and the state's lawsuit. That decision is expected this week. The landlord of the Portland ICE facility, Stuart Lindquist, is challenging the permit violation served to his tenant by the city. Portland found at least 25 violations of the ICE facility's permit. Specifically, ICE detained people at the building for longer than 12 hours, something barred by the city. Lindquist is challenging the violation, which puts the next steps in the permit violation process on hold. Lindquist is also remembered for admitting to hitting an anti-ICE demonstrator with his car in 2018. Several protesters allege that he accelerated into them on purpose.
The Portland City Council meets at 6 p.m. tonight, and they'll be introducing a resolution called the Protect Portland Initiative. It's being introduced by Councilors Olivia Clark, Candace Avalos, Tiffany Koyama-Lane, and Ilana Pirtle-Ginney. The resolution denounces any attempts to deploy military personnel to Portland. It acknowledges that, quote, Portland has already experienced unlawful and harmful deployments of unidentified federal agents in past years, end quote. The resolution reaffirms the city's sanctuary city commitments and calls on the mayor to make certain changes in the administration of the city. The Protect Portland Initiative would have the mayor create a citywide immigrant affairs liaison, provide new training on sanctuary responsibilities for city staff, and create a centralized information hub. It would also have the mayor create regular reports on federal enforcement activity in Portland, develop rapid response networks, and clearly label public and non-public spaces in city buildings. The initiative also asked the mayor to ensure Portland police remain under local control. The written testimony on the item has 70 responses so far, overwhelmingly in support of the resolution.
Oregon lawmakers rushed back into session in September to pass the transportation package, a compromise bill that didn't go as far as transportation advocates wanted, and still did too much taxation for many conservatives. The package passed both houses of the state legislature. All that's left for Oregon's Governor Tina Kotek is to sign it. Why hasn't she done it yet? Kotek tells OPB, quote, when I get the paperwork, I'm going to look at it. We'll have it signed by the time I need to have it signed, end quote. That deadline is November 12th. Kotek isn't dragging her feet for no reason. Conservatives intend to refer the bill to the ballot for voter approval, hopefully to ultimately reject the transportation package. Citizens that collect enough valid signatures 90 days after the legislature adjourns gives Oregonians veto power over the new law. There's a catch. Opponents of the transportation package can't start gathering signatures until the governor signs the bill. That likely means that they'll have more limited time, 54 days. They'll need to gather over 78,000 signatures by December 30th.
A new audit of Portland's park systems shows how political influence and insufficient financial planning have kept the city building new parks it can't afford, while failing to maintain older parks. The Parks Bureau admits that nearly 90% of all of its facilities are in poor condition. It would cost between $500 and $800 million to restore all park facilities to a, quote, reasonable level. The audit, written by city auditor Simone Reddy, says, quote, while Portlanders may enjoy new splash pads or shelters today, future residents may inherit unsafe or unusable assets the city cannot afford to maintain or remove, end quote. One significant factor in the problem is the Bureau's reliance on system development charges, which are fees that developers pay. This money goes directly to the Parks Bureau's budget, but can only be used on new projects, not maintenance. Portland voters will be receiving ballots in the coming days to vote on whether to approve a new parks levy, which is a 75% increase over the previous. It's a property tax that would cost $1.40 per $1,000 of assessed value per property. It's estimated to cost the average homeowner $310 a year, about an $11 increase from the parks levy that expires at the end of the year. With the funds, the Park Department will allegedly fund regular maintenance, improvement projects, and preserve free and discounted activities and classes for families. Without the levy, their budget would be cut in half.
Experts are raising alarm as the critical energy infrastructure hub in Northwest Portland, home to 90% of Oregon's liquid fuel, comes up for a policy renewal. They warn that an earthquake or fire at the site could cause one of the worst industrial disasters in U.S. history, and that Oregon must begin transitioning away from the site. Isabel Charlet has the details.
Portland City Council is updating policies for the critical energy infrastructure hub, and experts say without stronger regulation, an earthquake or fire at the site could have devastating statewide impacts. The CEI hub is a 6-mile stretch of fuel tanks along the Willamette River in northwest Portland that store 90% of Oregon's liquid fuel. Breach Collective attorney Nick Caleb says the hub was built 100 years ago on top of wetlands with fill soil, meaning the land beneath would likely liquefy in the event of a large earthquake.
We're overdue for the big one, as they say, in the Pacific Northwest. And so all that infrastructure is very vulnerable. And if we do have a large seismic event, then we're going to have one of the worst disasters in U.S. history right in the middle of Portland, Oregon.
Portland City Council is reviewing 4 proposals to update the CEI hub regulations, only one of which would reduce the amount of fuel stored on site. Caleb says industry lobbyists are advocating for weaker rules, and the public can comment on the proposals until October 17th. Scientific models predict a large earthquake is likely within the next few decades, and Portland is especially vulnerable to its effects. Research by Portland State University found that if the pressurized containers at the hub are broken, the resulting chemical spill could kill more than 2,500 people and injure more than 17,000. Caleb adds, in the event of such a disaster, the whole region would be impacted.
If all liquid fuel storage in the state is ignited and spills into the Willamette, people just won't have fuel, and that will pose other human health and economic problems throughout the state.
Caleb adds that while slowly reducing the hub's fuel reserves would be a step in the right direction, it isn't enough.
These are technologies of the past that we just need to be aggressively moving away from. We have alternatives that are safer, that are better, that allow for more autonomy and independence.
For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
Donald Trump posthumously awarded America's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, to Charlie Kirk, a far-right activist who was assassinated in September. Kirk is credited for inspiring a generation of young conservatives and helping push the nation's politics much further to the right. His rhetoric was noted to be homophobic, racist, transphobic, sexist, and xenophobic. The award comes just over a month after Kirk was fatally shot while speaking to a crowd at Utah Valley University. This was the first time Trump has awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom in his second term. He previously spoke at Kirk's funeral in September, calling him a great American hero and martyr for freedom. The award was established by President John F. Kennedy in 1963 for individuals making exceptional contributions, quote, to the security or national interests of the United States, world peace, cultural or other significant public or private endeavors. Trump has awarded a host of presidential medals dating back to his first term, including to a number of sports legends like Tiger Woods, Lou Holtz, and Mariano Rivera, as well as the conservative economist Arthur Laffer and right-wing radio host Rush Limbaugh. He also awarded posthumous medals to Babe Ruth and Elvis Presley. During the ceremony, the Trump administration said it had revoked the visas of 6 foreigners accused of making derisive comments about Kirk's assassination.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
No administration should be able to sidestep the Constitution and hold someone indefinitely without giving that person a fair and full chance to be heard.
Miriam Udine at the Muslim Legal Fund of America says the detention of Texas community leader Marwan Maruf by immigration authorities for 3 weeks without any hearing is offensive to constitutional due process rights. The Department of Homeland Security argues that unlike native-born citizens, migrants like Maruf can be held indefinitely without trial. A federal judge has ordered the government to justify its position by early November. Organizers say they have more than 2,400 No Kings rallies planned nationwide this weekend after thousands of similar events in June. Ariel Torres with the 5051 movement says this time people in at least 9 Nevada cities plan to protest Trump administration abuses.
It's assault after assault after assault on our rights that are supposed to be constitutional rights, as well as trying to ignore due process and the things that our democracy has been founded on.
The White House consistently argues their policies reflect the will of the voters as expressed by his election and will impose order. With the shutdown showing no sign of ending, President Donald Trump says he will continue to target federal funding for blue areas and what he calls democratic programs. But local governments say they need federal grants passed by Congress for routine health and safety efforts. Tina Hodges with Atlas Public Policy points to Tampa Bay's Safe Streets and Roads for All effort to curb pedestrian deaths by building historically underfunded infrastructure.
ensuring that people can have the ability to bike, or there's a lot of breaks in the sidewalk network where if you wanted to go someplace that's even not very far away, you can't safely get there.
California labor unions are joining environmental advocates to defend offshore wind energy after the administration suspended new leases and revoked hundreds of millions in funding. Mark Simonin with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers says the technology represents a rare opportunity for working families.
There will be operation and maintenance. There will be small manufacturing, warehousing. There's going to be multiple jobs through multiple sectors. So it will be a real positive impact for the working class folks.
Supreme Court justices are weighing whether to narrow Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, an important safeguard for minority representation key to how congressional maps are drawn. Conservatives say the law gives federal courts too much sway over state elections, but civil rights advocates warn weakening it would permit racial gerrymandering. In an unusual show of unity, every major broadcast network, from Fox to CNN, has refused to sign the Pentagon's new press access policy, calling it a violation of First Amendment principles. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Vera and Michelle from the African American Alliance for Homeownership. Tonight on KABU, it's Radio, Radio, Radio. At 6, it's Sea Change Radio. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be mostly clear, with an overnight low of 41 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be partly sunny, with a high of 62. Today in history, in 1582, the Gregorian calendar was introduced by Pope Gregory XIII. It is now the most widely used solar calendar. The quote of the day is from German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, born this day in 1844. He said, "Distrust all in whom the impulse to punish is powerful."
Over 1,000 people are displaced and one is dead after Typhoon Halong in western Alaska. Tribes, community groups, and businesses are pitching in on the recovery effort. With that story and more, it's Antonio Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The remnants of Typhoon Halong over the weekend have left at least one woman dead and more than 1,000 people displaced in western Alaska. The disaster happened right before the start of the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention and the Elders and Youth Conference. The Alaska Desk's Ayolna Nidem reports that the storm is shaping the tone of this year's events.
The Alaska Federation of Natives Convention always focuses on issues most pertinent to local indigenous communities. And this year, a catastrophic storm that battered predominantly Alaska Native villages is already the center of the conversations. Senator Lisa Murkowski spoke at the beginning of the Elders and Youth Conference, the traditional prologue to the main AFN event.
As we gather for this sharing and this collective convening, let us keep in mind those that are in harm's way and those who are out there to be with them and to help them.
Communities and rescue groups are still looking for missing people and assessing the damage from the storm. Meanwhile, AFN and other local indigenous organizations are looking for ways to help. AFN is one of 12 mostly indigenous organizations that formed the Western Alaska Disaster Relief Fund to provide assistance to villages. On Thursday, AFN plans to hold a blanket dance fundraiser for the disaster. Roy Glowin is the president of the First Alaskans Institute that hosts the Elders and Youth Conference. On Sunday, he spoke about the destruction from the storm.
It's easy to feel distant, but I ask you to lean in, because while the storm may be hundreds of miles away, the people affected are our neighbors, our friends, and our family.
Marilyn Atley is a healer from the interior who participated in the Elders and Youth Conference. She invited attendees, especially young people, to talk about what they feel and consider visiting a healing station.
You have to make up your own mind to be resilient. Any type of loss that you're going to go through in your life, any type of happening, problem, you have to make up your own mind to overcome it.
The Elders and Youth Conference is running at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage through Wednesday. AFN is scheduled there from Thursday to Saturday. With reporting help from Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, I am Alona Naiden.
Meanwhile, community groups and businesses across the state are coordinating storm relief efforts for the devastated communities. The Alaska Community Foundation has partnered with local and regional organizations to create the Western Alaska Disaster Relief Fund. The foundation's Ashley Ellingson says they're distributing the funds to communities hit hardest.
It's geared towards immediate support and then long-term resilience. And the thing that's unique about this fund is that we have partnered with local and regional organizations to make sure that the money goes to those, to the areas that it's needed most.
The fund is a partnership with the Alaska Federation of Natives, the Association of Village Council Presidents, the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, and a number of other groups serving Alaskans in the region. As of Tuesday afternoon, the fund had raised more than $300,000 from donors. Jenny Ragland, chair of Alaska Voluntary Organizations Active in Disaster, says cash donations are a better option than goods, since storing and transporting items can present challenges of their own.
While it may seem impersonal, cash really is the best opportunity to help meet those immediate needs that are coming our way. It provides flexibility for us to purchase exactly what's needed, to procure those items quickly, and to get them into the hands of disaster survivors.
More information about the effort is online at alaskacf.org. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Federal lawmakers have proposed some major revisions to the Marine Mammal Protection Act, a landmark law credited with improving populations of several species, including the North Atlantic right whale. Conservation groups in New England warn a rollback of protection could cause irreversible harm to the ocean ecosystem. Catherine Carley tells us more.
Conservation groups in New England warn a rollback of protections for marine mammals could cause irreversible harm to the ocean ecosystem. Republicans in Congress have proposed deep revisions to the federal Marine Mammal Protection Act, a landmark law credited in the recovery of humpback, gray, and North Atlantic right whales. Gib Brogan with the advocacy organization Oceana says draft legislation would change the definition of harm to these species and lower population goals.
The draft bill proposes a wide range of deep, unnecessary changes that will have significant effects on marine mammals across the country and around the world.
He calls the current law effective and flexible, allowing for dialogue between conservation groups, scientists, and industry. But some fishing groups see the law as antiquated, with regulations that threaten their livelihoods. A congressman from Alaska is proposing the changes. Enforcement of the regulations has grown more challenging due to layoffs at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. A recent report from NOAA found a dramatic rise in the number of whale entanglements in fishing gear off the New England coast. Brogan says funding cuts are hampering the agency's ability to guide marine conservation.
These people have very important roles, and the oceans are suffering because the NOAA experts aren't out there doing their jobs.
Groups like the Maine Lobstering Union say restrictions on equipment meant to protect marine mammals offer little protection, yet hinder their ability to operate. The law also bans seafood imports from foreign fisheries that fail to meet U.S. standards. A coalition of fishing groups recently sued NOAA over the current law, claiming businesses and jobs are at stake. For New England News Service, I'm Catherine Carley.
The Trump administration has secretly authorized the CIA to conduct covert action in Venezuela. This is the latest step in the administration's increasing pressure against Nicolas Maduro, the country's authoritarian leader. The U.S. military has been targeting boats off the Venezuelan coast as it claims are transporting drugs, killing at least 27 people. The new authority would allow the CIA to carry out lethal operations in Venezuela and conduct a range of operations in the Caribbean, including actions coordinated with the U.S. military. There are currently 10,000 U.S. troops in the Caribbean, most of them at bases in Puerto Rico. When the Navy has 8 warships and a submarine in the Caribbean, as well as a contingent of Marines on amphibious assault ships, Trump ended diplomatic talks with the Maduro government this month, as Maduro ignored U.S. demands to give up power voluntarily, and Venezuelan officials insist they have no part in drug trafficking. Trump was asked this afternoon if the U.S. is considering strikes on suspected drug cartels in Venezuela. Trump said the administration is, quote, looking at land.
High land costs, student debt, and climate shocks make it hard for the next generation of farmers to get started and to stay on their land. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Starting a new farm can be hard, especially for young people.
And staying in farming is harder.
Vanessa Garcia Polanco of the National Young Farmers Coalition says most farms in the U.S. are passed from one generation to the next, and land is expensive. So to join the industry, young people who do not inherit property must have access to credit, and many are already saddled with student loan debt. So often, young farmers operate on tight margins and cannot afford crop insurance, and that puts them in a precarious spot if a severe storm or drought strikes.
More established farmers, they will have more capital, they will have land tenure. So for a young farmer who experiences any climate shock or climate event, it just becomes more risky.
And the blow may be too severe for them to recover. For example, Polanco says her group's Texas chapter was hit hard by a severe winter storm in 2021.
The chapter had like 20 people and most of them stopped farming and we literally had to close the chapter down.
To give new farmers a better chance of success, the coalition is advocating for federal programs that help them access land and capital so more young people can start farming and stay afloat even if disaster strikes.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Behavioral health care providers are now being taught a new method to identify depression, anxiety, and other issues among farmers. Eric Galatas has more in Wyoming.
Farmers in Wyoming and across the U.S. face many stressors, from economic troubles to unpredictable weather, and they have one of the highest rates of suicide of any occupation. Behavioral health care providers are now being taught a new method to identify depression, anxiety, and other issues among farmers. LandLogic co-developer Kayla Anderson, who grew up on a farm, says farmers don't typically talk about their emotions, but asking them to draw a map of their land and explain what happens and where helps start a conversation that can reveal underlying emotional struggles.
Because we believe that licensed behavioral health providers that may be wanting to serve this population just need that one little piece to connect, and then their knowledge and expertise and their work with the farmer can take off from there.
A cattle feedlot, for instance, might be a source of intense stress when there isn't enough money to feed the cattle, or a reliable field of alfalfa could be a place where a farmer finds solace. Anderson notes farmers are problem solvers by necessity. The therapists LandLogic trains learn how to identify mental health issues using associations with everyday agricultural tools, like a pair of favorite work gloves. They then help farmers learn to overcome challenges on their own as they spend time out on their land. Therapists are also taught how to identify 10 common negative thinking patterns that Anderson calls barbed wire thinking, including toxic grit, when farmers continue to toil away even when it's causing them harm.
The get her done, pull yourselves up by the bootstraps, there's no time for emotions. That piece is part of what has kept farmers farming and is a very good skill set until the moment it's not.
Farmers are good at their jobs because they're deeply attached to their land and are at risk when that role is threatened. Anderson says the moment they see how this agricultural imperative impacts their behavior is a launching point. Once they can name it, they can own it and work it out.
Naming it and claiming it is one of the most important parts of land logic for the farmer because it brings so much light and you can see it. You can see it visibly when they have that moment of clarity, and that's really powerful and awesome to watch.
This is Eric Galatas for the Wyoming News Service.
All KBOO news poet Dan Raphael is saying is, give facts a chance.
Sometimes there's nothing new to say. Some phrases become cliches because they engender hope, which is also a crutch. I don't feel hope, but that there's maybe a chance. Now is macro, while change is micro. Face to face, not screen to screen. The court seemed confused about what's a fact. Some judges saying if Trump says it, it must be so. Like media wasn't sure how many were in the emergency naked bike ride. The Oregonians started out saying over 1,000, then said several thousand. OPB said hundreds, while The Guardian didn't cite a number. What more important things are no one sure about? The two most crucial facts to me are Trump must resign, and that won't solve much. Odds are things will get worse before they get better. Warren Zevon's advice as he neared death was enjoy every sandwich. As I find myself most mornings warming with love and joy looking at my wife, I am so fortunate. I trust there are times you can feel that way too. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, October 15th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem, Dan Raphael, and Anna Wilcox. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodewell. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Antonio Gonzalez, Farah Siddiqui, Eric Galatas, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, on 104.3 FM, and K220 Hood River on 91.9 FM.
That's K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KABU programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KABU to 44321. Stay tuned now for KABU's News in Depth.